time.
You're listening to BBC Radio 4 Extra.
And now we come to part four of Did You Really Shoot the Television? Max Hastings' recollections of his family, his childhood and life with his Fleet Street parents. Today, at last, the story of the family's beleaguered TV set.
Max's father, my grandfather, was an author, journalist and playwright, Basil MacDonald Hastings. Uncle Lewis was his brother. As boys, games with Lewis and Basil involved model soldiers and bangs. In those Victorian days, gunpowder could be bought loose across the counter like tea or sugar. It was regarded, even by their father, as a perfectly normal playroom accessory in the house in Trinity Square, Borough. One day, Lewis and Basil made a bomb by wrapping sixpence worth of black powder in an oily rag, placing it inside their wooden fort, then laying a powder trail to the door of the nursery. The pater was summoned to witness the climactic moment. There was a thunderous crash as the fort and its lead soldiers blew apart. The watchers coughed and spluttered in ecstasy under a nursery full of smoke. The mater threw a fit. When Basil was 30 in 1911, he wrote a comic play entitled The New Sin, which became the hit of the London season. Like all the family, Basil lived for the day, spent freely, and took no heed for the morrow. His subsequent plays were less successful. When he died, in his 40s, he left his wife and children almost penniless. Mac, in his last year at public school, was abruptly brought home. For a few miserable months, the young man devilled as a clerk at Scotland Yard. Then his fortunes improved. He found a job in the publicity department of J. Lyons, located at 61 Fleet Street. Lyons dominated Britain's catering industry, with tea shops in almost every town, together with prestige hotels and restaurants in London, of which the Trocadero in Piccadilly Circus was the most famous. Mac discovered that he was good at writing advertising copy and that Lyons offered opportunities to enjoy what a somewhat credulous young man perceived as the high life. Almost every night, dressed in white tie and tails, he disported himself at one or other of the company's restaurants or show palaces. He didn't pretend to love Lyons, he really did so. His trouble was that he never knew when to stop. It was tremendous fun to party with chorus girls, but in 1936 he went a disastrous step further and married one. The alliance lasted only a few months, but he was obliged to pay his ex-wife maintenance almost until the day he died. Mac was prompted to make a clean break with Lyons by an experience one night in 1938 as he stood waiting for a girl in the foyer of a restaurant clad in carnation, white tie and tails. Tapping a patent leather shoe impatiently, he was reflecting upon what a fine figure he cut when a stranger approached, demanding, "Have you got a table for two?" When the legendary BBC programme Tonight burst upon the airwaves in 1957, Mac achieved his greatest popular success. But like his father Basil, his commercial instincts were non-existent, and without my mother's income, the family would have been shipwrecked. And if the careers of Mac and Anne appeared to be flying high, their domestic life was increasingly wretched. They lived almost entirely separate existences. Once, we all went on holiday together in the south of France. I revelled in the luxuries of the blue train, but otherwise the trip was not a success. Whatever the willful delusions of parents, few small children enjoy Nice as much as Newquay. English sand is miles better than foreign muck, as I told the parents frankly after our trip to Cavalier. Thereafter, a new summer routine was adopted. Our parents went their own separate ways. while Nanny was dispatched with my sister and me to Frinton, Broadstairs, or, in red-letter years, to a Butlin's holiday camp. Clacton, Filey, Margate, we tried them all and were entranced. The food was great, the pools and boating lakes and mini-railways free and impeccably supervised. At 12, my highest ambition was to become a Butlin's redcoat. Those trips represent almost the only periods of my childhood during which I never got into trouble. My prep school, Horace Hill, was generally underwhelmed by me. When I was 12, one of my headmasters, about to administer a routine whacking, said, "Winchester have just asked us whether, in our opinion, you are the sort of boy they should wish to have. We have been obliged to tell them that you are not." I went to Charterhouse instead, where I proved as considerable a disappointment as I had been at Horace Hill. By that stage, my parents were relieved to have identified any institution willing to admit me. Mac wrote to my housemaster,
"There is no doubt that he is idyllically happy at the school."
Even Father, the heroic fantasist, however, was unable for long to sustain this delusion. A considerable factor in Anne's exasperation with him was her belief that he should play a larger role in taming me. I lived in an almost permanent state of apprehension when Mother was about the place, lest the latest of my depredations should be discovered. But I loved to listen to Father. A significant part of his romantic nature, as well as of his peculiar brand of conceit, was to assume that any product, establishment, or artist patronized by himself was absolutely the best of its kind imaginable. When he bought an Armstrong Siddeley motor car, he declared,
"People who really know about motors regard this machine as better than a Bentley."
He persuaded himself that Churchill's shotguns were superior to those of Purdy or Holland simply because he'd struck up a friendship with the gunmaker Robert Churchill. I would be surprised if Mac indulged in much sexual misbehaviour during his married life. His persistent infidelities were committed instead with firearms. Beside his battery of Churchill 12-bores, the house was strewn with 18th-century dueling pistols, 19th-century revolvers, percussion and flintlock sporting pieces. I never dared to fire those frail old weapons. Mac, however, indulged a phase when, in place of a modern shotgun, he deployed his 1820s Mantons against partridges and pheasants. It was an awesome sight to behold the flash of the flint as he fired, the black powder smoke which wreathed him for half a minute thereafter. The birds were seldom much troubled by these assaults, but they provided Father with enormous pleasure. I suppose it is not surprising that I shared his enthusiasm, but most of my dealings with his guns as a boy were illicit. From the age of 10 or 11 onwards, whenever my parents absented themselves from the cottage, I took possession of the family armoury. Nobody in those days locked up guns, and most of Father's stood ready to hand in a rack in the hall. I experimented with the hand-loading of cartridges, which caused Father some astonishment when he used them, unaware of their provenance. Those which I'd overcharged with powder yielded thunderous explosions, following which a few pellets sped towards the planets. The whiff of cordite whetted my appetite for more ambitious pleasures. In an oak chest in Father's room, he preserved his war souvenirs. A Polish radom, a broom-handle Mauser, and two Luger automatics, and most thrilling of all, a Schmeisser machine pistol, together with a plentiful stock of 9mm ammunition. At first, I confined myself merely to stripping and reassembling the guns, at which I became probably the most proficient 11-year-old in the world. Soon, inevitably, I dared to fire them. When the coast was clear and parents safely absent, I invited a few friends round for tea, cucumber sandwiches and pistol practice. The garden seat still bears the scars. Late one dark night, when Mother was at home and we were all in bed, I was awakened by stirrings outside the front door. Obviously an intruder. Thrilled that here was my opportunity to repel an assault on the household, I seized a pistol, flicked around in the breech, and crouched beside the open window, drawing a bead on a shadowy figure below. A knock on the door prompted Mother to peer out of her window. "Good evening, madam. Constable Jones. As I was passing, I noticed a bicycle outside and thought that somebody might be up to no good here." "No," said my mother wearily. "It was merely her son's machine, carelessly abandoned at the garden gate." Fortunate man, Constable Jones never knew how close he came to a sticky end in the line of duty. I suffered a stab of vague awareness that I was in danger of carrying a good thing too far. A report swept the family that on Father's return from his latest foreign assignment, all the World War II weapons would be removed from circulation. Appalled, I chose my favourite pistol, the Radom, and secreted it in the luggage, together with a generous supply of ammunition, when we returned to London from the cottage. An evening or two later, I was sitting in my room in the flat, watching an instalment of an American TV drama, Perry Mason as it happened. Most of my attention was on the screen, but as I viewed, I caressed, stripped, and reassembled the Radom, pushed in an ammunition clip, and snapped the gun at the screen. Mother, more than 40 years later on Desert Island Discs, did me a notable injustice by suggesting that I became overexcited while watching a Western. It was not a Western. I remember, as if it were yesterday, the spectacle of the TV disappearing in a sudden eruption of smoke and cascade of glass and clatter. I was so shocked by the effect on hearing a gunshot at close quarters in Cromwell Road that I slumped back in my chair, pistol dangling limply in my hand. This caused Mumsy, rushing in seconds later, to assume the worst. I reassured her that all was well with everything except the unfortunate television. Should you yourself contemplate firing a pistol in a Victorian mansion block and wonder whether the noise would trouble the neighbours, I can offer comfort. Nobody else in our flats complained about a thing. But even by the standards of our family, the ensuing row was a corker. Father, on his return from foreign parts, first demanded my assistance to sieve the wreckage of the TV and retrieve the bullet, lest its discovery by some third party lead to trouble, and a shooting expedition, on which the two of us were scheduled to embark a fortnight later, suddenly became a fishing holiday. Even Father, I think, was shocked by the intensity of my mother's fury, which was evenly distributed between the two of us. My enthusiasm for shooting was undiminished by the death of the television. I was simply sorry that I had been caught. Gosh, it was fun, until that silly moment when I overplayed my hand. I knew exactly how my grandfather and great-uncle felt when they blew up the toy fort in Trinity Square Borough.
And tomorrow, more trouble for Mac and Anne's later business with the small Picasso, as Max Hastings concludes his recollections of his parents. Did You Really Shoot the Television was written and read by Max Hastings, with additional readings by Nigel Hastings as Mac and Joanna Munro as Anne. The book was abridged by Penny Lester and the producer was Duncan Minchell. Now get drawn into our drama next Thursday when June Whitfield stars as the indomitable actress Margaret Rutherford. In a tour de force of name-dropping, she recounts some glamorous adventures in between entertaining Jordanian princes and falling in love with a pianist 30 years her junior.